From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, political oratory. Gary Will's new book analyzes how the Gettysburg Address changed the history of American political thought. We'll talk with Wills about his new book, Lincoln at Gettysburg. Then we'll ask him to evaluate the public speaking styles of the president, Ross Perot, and other politicians. Gary Wills is a political columnist and the author of critical studies of three presidents, Kennedy, Nixon, and Reagan. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker says the complaint that rap music is abrasive is less true now than ever. He reviews three new rap albums that prove his point. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Russian President Boris Yeltsin dined with the leaders of the G7 tonight. Tomorrow, he's scheduled to have serious discussions regarding help for the struggling Russian economy. NPR's John Idstey reports from Munich.
Unlike his predecessor Mikhail Gorbachev, who left last year's summit with only verbal encouragement, President Yeltsin won't go away from this summit empty-handed. Today, U.S. Secretary of State James Baker gave a status report on the G7 leaders' discussions on aid for Yeltsin and his country. Baker said the agreement over the weekend between Russia and the International Monetary Fund on Russia's economic reforms would pave the way for delivery of previously promised Western aid. Baker said the G7 leaders were inclined to endorse debt relief for Russia, although it may not be the two-year postponement of payments that Boris Yeltsin wants. The leaders are also ready to endorse a plan to help make safe dangerous Soviet-made nuclear power plants. That aid could total hundreds of millions of dollars. I'm John Idstey in Munich.
The Moldovan parliament voted overwhelmingly today to ask for peacekeeping troops from the Commonwealth of Independent States. The idea for a Commonwealth peacekeeping force was approved yesterday at the CIS summit in Moscow, but the troops have not yet been called up from the various republics. The peacekeeping force was designed with the Moldovan conflict specifically in mind, but Commonwealth leaders say the troops may be used in other trouble spots throughout the former Soviet Union. Moldovan authorities said that 22 people were killed and nearly 50 injured overnight in fighting between Moldovans and Slavic separatists. A Japanese government survey team has left Phnom Penh after assessing how Japanese can contribute to the UN peacekeeping operation, the first for Japan since the end of the Second World War. Sue Downey says the assessment team's report to the Tokyo government will form the basis of Japan's military contribution to the UN.
The head of the UN mission is Japan's Yasushi Takashi, and Japan is the second largest contributor to the $2.5 billion peacekeeping operation. But so far, Japan's role has been restricted to civil tasks. However, last month, the Japanese Diet passed legislation which allows Japan to send non-combat troops abroad for the first time since 1945, and Cambodia will be the first country to receive Japanese soldiers. The 15-member survey team left Phnom Penh saying they would report to the Japanese government, which would decide, in consultation with the UN, how many troops to send and when. For National Public Radio, this is Sue Downey in Phnom Penh.
Stock prices fell sharply today on Wall Street in what analysts said was anxiety over corporate earnings in the second quarter. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 44 points to close at 3,295. Declines led advances by a margin of 10-7 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. The International Air Transport Association said today that the world's airlines stand to lose $2 billion on scheduled international flights this year. As big as that loss appears, the industry group said it actually amounts to a turnaround for the air carriers, which lost $4 billion last year. IATA's director told reporters that it's now a question of how much of a financial recovery the industry will see in 1992. New Jersey is instituting what it calls the most wide-ranging job training and retraining program in the nation. Gene Dillard reports the legislation authorizing the initiative was signed by Governor Jim Florio in Trenton today.
It's known as the Workforce Development Partnership Act, and it sets a national model by the type and scale of training it offers. The program will provide customized skills training for the unemployed, people who have exhausted their jobless benefits, and workers employed by firms seeking to expand or maintain a competitive edge. New Jersey Governor Jim Florio says businesses will be able to respond to changes and opportunities in today's global economy.
It improves our living standard, and it gives people the new skills that they're going to need to be able to move up the rungs of the economic ladder.
Florio says the retraining is particularly important since modern-day workers must continually update their skills. Unlike many of their parents, he says they won't be doing the same job for the rest of their lives. For National Public Radio, I'm Gene Dillard in Trenton, New Jersey.
The Chicago Cubs have sued baseball commissioner Faye Vincent in an effort to stop him from moving the club into the National League West. The suit, filed in Chicago, calls for a preliminary injunction to stop the commissioner from realigning the league in 1993. Vincent announced yesterday that the Cubs and the St. Louis Cardinals will go west, while the Atlanta Braves and the Cincinnati Reds will move into the National League East. The complaint says the Cubs and their fans will face irreparable injury if they're moved because the change would disrupt traditional team rivalries. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Democratic Convention is next week, and we'll be hearing lots of speeches. My guest Gary Wills has written a new book about one of the greatest speeches in American political history, the Gettysburg Address. If Lincoln's speech has been reduced to a cliché in your mind, stick around and listen to Gary Wills read and interpret it. In his new book, Lincoln at Gettysburg, Wills describes the address as words that remade America. Wills has written three critical studies of American presidents, Nixon Agonistis, the Kennedy imprisonment, and Reagan's America. He recently wrote a profile of Ross Perot, which we'll discuss later. He's also written about the collision of religion and politics in America. The Gettysburg Address was delivered at the dedication of the Battlefield Cemetery where thousands of soldiers fell after one of the bloodiest battles of the Civil War, the Battle of Gettysburg in 1863.
The battles ended on July 3rd, and on July 4th, people woke up, and this little village of 2,000-some people found 8,000 dead bodies in their fields and gardens and farms, and six or so dead bodies of horses and mules. So just covering them up at first was a tremendous problem. Then after they had done that, pretty much hugger-mugger wherever they lay, people started coming from Union states, families, delegations from the states, trying to reclaim the bodies and take them back for honorable burial. But nobody knew where their contingents were, where individuals were, so they were rummaging around, turning up bodies almost at random. This presented such a health hazard that the Pennsylvania authorities said, no, you can't take the bodies away. And they set up an interstate commission to finance and govern a new cemetery. But they couldn't start moving the bodies until the first frost came, which means that as they tried to identify them, they had been lying in the ground for 3 months at the outset and for 9 months by the time they finally finished up. It was very hard to identify bodies. They had to take the southerners away. They had to find out what state each northern body came from. They had to do ghastly things like try to sort out separated body parts according to the proper trunk. So it was a very grisly thing, and only 2,000 or less, about a third of the cemetery was filled when Lincoln came there. They hadn't been able to beat the freeze of the ground, and so they had to continue in the spring. So it was all very unfinished. There was no monument. Lincoln could not speak in the obvious place because people would have been treading on these fresh graves. So he had to speak higher up the hill. So it was a time for healing, and that's why the local representative, David Wills, had appointed Edward Everett, the great orator, to come and give his customary two-hour speech, which was very popular. He drew a tremendous crowd. If he had not been there, 15,000 people would not have heard Lincoln speak, because Lincoln didn't have that drawing power.
How do you think Lincoln saw his mission with the Gettysburg Address?
Well, he knew about these cemetery dedications. They were big cultural events in his time, and he had been to at least one that we know of in Springfield. Getting people out into nature was a transcendentalist cause in the mid-19th century. They wanted to get away from the churchyards and go out into nature where people would come and meditate on death. They loved these liminal experiences of crossing barriers between life and death, sleep and awake, etc. So these cemeteries were considered schools of learning. In fact, children were deputed to go and take care of them so that they could contemplate death from an early age. And he knew that. He had consulted the man who laid out the cemetery, William Sanders, who told him that he had carefully plotted it so that there was no hierarchical order, no precedence of officers over men or this state over that state. So lying in the ground, they enacted, as it were, the idea that all men are created equal. Lincoln had invited him to the executive mansion to discuss this, the rationale. It was part of his preparation. He had clearly prepared very carefully, not waiting to scribble on the train or wherever at the last minute.
You know, I'm sure I'm not alone in being one of the many students who had to memorize some or all of the Gettysburg Address. I can't remember how much I had to memorize. All I remember is 4 score and 7 years ago, which I kind of remembered as 4 score and 20 years ago. I mean, I didn't even get that right. And so it was really interesting for me to go through your book and to reread the address and realize, wow, it really is beautifully written. I never, ever noticed that in all the times that I've had to read the address, to tell you the truth. And I never really thought of it as colloquial either. But you've put it in historical context in the book and show how this really was incredibly colloquial for its time for oratory.
Well, I wouldn't exactly call it colloquial. It was brief, certainly. It was pregnant. It was not flowery. There are very few overt images. But the language is actually quite Latinate. You know, he says things like conceived in liberty, not born in freedom, dedicated to the proposition, not sworn to a truth, etc. And it's very abstract. He doesn't mention particulars. He never even mentions Gettysburg. He doesn't mention the North or the South or slavery or the Union. It's astonishing what he does not mention. He talks about this in an almost scientific way, that this is an experiment in freedom. We're finding out here whether this nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated, anything in that category, can long endure. And if we prove that the experiment is survivable, then liberty shall not perish from the earth. So as opposed to Everett, who went into tremendous detail about the battle and excoriated the South for invading this peaceful valley and that kind of thing, Lincoln, as usual, talks above North and South of a great national mission that's being worked out in the war. And of course, that's why he wanted to go there so badly. He was trying to redefine the mission of the nation in the midst of war so that they would come out of these horrendous scenes, these bloody battles, the beginning of modern warfare, really, with all of the technology of death, with a new birth, as he calls it, of freedom, that we went back to our origins and realized that we hadn't lived up to the proposition that all men are created equal. We'd had slavery, we'd had these other things. But now we have to continue the effort that the fathers dedicated us to when they brought this nation out of the continent in a kind of virgin birth at the beginning.
How does the language of the Gettysburg Address compare with the typical oratory of the time?
Well, as I say, it's less flowery. For one thing, it's brief. He realized that the attention span was getting shorter. He and Mark Twain came to this realization at about the same time.
Hey, and this was before television.
Absolutely.
Couldn't
blame
that.
But it was the time of the telegraph, of steam, of the railroad. The pace of life had picked up. And, of course, Lincoln was tremendously aware of that because he was at the center of the telegraphic communiques from all the battlefields with all of his generals. He used to go across to the War Office, right across from the Executive Mansion then, and spend hours sending and receiving telegrams. And he was very upset at officials and generals and engineers and others who would send him these verbose things where he's waiting for the message and they go on for sentence after sentence after sentence. He's not finding what he wants to hear. He liked Grant because Grant had tremendous economy of language too. Grant proved to be a very good writer after the war. But he had this sense that life was picking up. So in the address, he rarely uses and or but or that kind of thing. He uses ascendaton, as the rhetoricians say. It's we cannot dedicate, we cannot hallow, we cannot consecrate these staccato phrases coming at you, government of the people, by the people, for the people. It's not government of the people and, or government of the people, by the people, and for the people. He drops all of those things. So there's a tremendous leanness and tautness to the address.
I think this would be a good time for me to ask you to read the Gettysburg Address. And I think a lot of our listeners will hear it differently than they've heard it before. And let me reintroduce you. My guest is Gary Wills, and his new book is about the Gettysburg Address. It's called Lincoln at Gettysburg, The Words That Remade America. And what do you say? You want to give it a go?
Okay. 67 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation, or any nation, so conceived and so dedicated, can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that that nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this, but in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate. We cannot consecrate. We cannot hallow this ground. The brave men living and dead who struggled here have consecrated it far above our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather, to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
You describe the Gettysburg Address as having revolutionized the revolution, and as having changed the way people thought about the Constitution. How?
Well, it culminated a long campaign that he had undertaken in the late 1850s to get away from the problem posed by a Constitution that recognized slavery. He said we have to look back to the Declaration of Independence, which pledged us to the proposition that all men are created equal, and treat the Constitution as a first attempt at achieving that ideal, which still has to be worked on. The ideal remains, though the embodiment and various forms of government can and should change. This was an elaborate trap that he had laid for Stephen Douglas in his debates with him. He kept saying over and over in various ways, oh, you want to get rid of the Declaration of Independence? And he said, well, no, I don't really want to do that, because, of course, it was a sacred symbol by then. And he said, well, what do you make of that clause about all men being created equal? Or what do you make of the idea that we are one people? Because Jefferson began by saying, when in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the bonds which tie them to another people. He was going against the idea that the Constitution was merely a compact between sovereign states. So all of this is concentrated in the tremendous prominence he gives to the Declaration in the Gettysburg Address. You notice he begins 67 years ago, which takes us back to 1776. If he had wanted to take us back to 1789 in the Constitution, he would have had to say 66 years ago our country was brought forth. When he ends up saying government of the people, that had become a fighting phrase for him, because the Southerners and their supporters in the North, and Stephen Douglas in particular, had said, we are not one people, we are a collection of different peoples, different states, each of them actually or potentially sovereign, who can resume their sovereignty at will. Now, Lincoln had some warrant for this in various legal doctrines, but it was not the preeminent view. He made it that in the course of his long campaign in this. His first inaugural address spells it out in great detail. But all of that is implicit in the Gettysburg Address. And because the address became so rapidly a touchstone of what the war was all about, he made people think of the country as dedicated to equality and as single in its peopleness, so that up until the time of the war, everybody always used the United States as a plural noun. The United States are a government by contract or whatever. From the time the war ended, everybody uniformly used it as a singular noun. The United States is a government of regular procedures.
Well, I want to talk with you more about the oratory of today in politics, but first we're going to take a short break. And if you're just joining us, my guest is Gary Wills. His new book is Lincoln at Gettysburg. It's an analysis of the Gettysburg Address and how it changed political oratory and political thought in America. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Gary Wills is my guest, and in addition to his new book, Lincoln at Gettysburg, he's the author of several other books about American presidents, including Reagan's America and Nixon Agonistes. His previous book before his latest is called Under God, and that was a collection of essays on the collision of religion and politics in America. Let me tell you something I'm not sure of. It seems to me today people are almost consciously trying not to be subtle in their public oratory because they're afraid people won't get it. And I'm wondering if you think that the thousands of people who were assembled to hear Lincoln got all the kinds of subtleties that you're talking about now.
No, I don't think most of them got it at the first go.
Well, it wasn't played back on video afterwards.
Well, but it immediately went into print, and the text was read and available. But a lot of people would have got it. He certainly read it well. He was a great deliverer of speeches. We tend to forget that. He had a high tenor voice that carried very well outdoors. And he had wonderful timing. He was a great storyteller, so he always knew how to reach the punchline. He loved to read Shakespeare out loud, Shakespearean speeches, and other speeches for that matter. Reading speeches was his principal reading. He loved the word, and he loved the spoken word. I think it would have been understood basically by people, but there's always more. I'm still understanding it more and more as I read it. But you talk about current speeches, that kind of the ability to refer somewhat subtly, as you say, is a little hard in the modern world. Probably one of the last bastions of that is church oratory, because there is a common stock of biblical knowledge or phrases, so that I suppose the last great speech delivered in this country was Dr. King's at the March on Washington.
The I Have a Dream speech.
Yes, which begins, by the way, 50 years ago. It picks right up from the Declaration, from the Gettysburg Address. He goes back to that.
Looking back over the past few presidents, is there anyone who you would call a great speech maker? But I'm thinking, even if you did, you'd be talking about the way they delivered somebody else's lines, because virtually no politicians write their own speeches anymore.
That's true. On the other hand, we shouldn't assume that you cannot be a great president unless you write your own speeches. Franklin Roosevelt didn't write his own speeches.
You mean a great president or a great orator?
Well, even he was a fairly good orator, too. George Washington didn't write his own speeches. You can have Ronald Reagan delivered the texts that were given to him well. He was a practiced orator. So I don't think the secret is that you have to write your own speeches. Roosevelt didn't write the first inaugural address, for instance, which certainly had an impact on the nation.
Oh, but I know when I was growing up and I found out that there were speechwriters, I felt really cheated. I thought, well, I was under the impression that these guys were speaking from their heart. And they'd sat down and they'd struggle through what they wanted to say and what words they wanted to use. And we were witnessing the results of that. And then I realized, no, that, you know, they've someone's on salary to do this kind of thing. And then they read it either, you know, the president or the candidate reads it either well or poorly, you know.
Yes, but I don't think that you should judge an oration simply in terms of that. You're arguing as if there's something inauthentic, that it's not their own words. That's the same kind of argument that makes people want Lincoln to have improvised or to have written at the last minute. They think that the more spontaneous it is, the more sincere it is, the more authentic, and that if it's worked out, if you've put in elbow grease and midnight oil and that kind of thing, that it's somehow not as authentic, it's phony, it's more distant. Lincoln certainly didn't think that. He wrote all of his speeches very slowly, and his law partner Herndon said that he did the same with his law briefs. He was a slow, careful composer. He was not spontaneous, and in fact, as president, he refused constantly to give speeches when he was called on the spur of the moment. He said, my words are too important. And we're talking about ghostwriting. Lincoln is interesting because he ghostwrote in reverse. He wrote some of the documents for his subordinates. He knew that getting the phrasing just right was so important as he tried to define the whole meaning of this struggle that he would write documents for the War Office to release.
I wonder if you think that in their own way speeches are becoming obsolete, especially now that candidates are talking more in an interview context and with mass media functioning the way they do. You don't need to make a speech at a pulpit for a lot of people to be able to hear you, you know, or at a platform.
Well, certainly the ease of communication through television has made it harder to give a formal speech. You know, it was a shock to many people when Roosevelt came into their homes with the so-called fireside addresses. Actually, they were quite stilted, too, if we go back and look at them, but people had not been used to having a president speak in their home. They had normally seen him in newsreels or at the theater or something of that sort. We certainly have got a more relaxed, more informal style for day-to-day use. On the other hand, people do want major speeches, and they feel disappointed when people don't come up to them. You remember that it was expected that Bush would give a major speech on the State of the Union this year, and when he didn't, people thought he had really missed an important opportunity. And when a good speech comes along, like that of Cuomo to the Democratic convention, or Dr. King's, or some of Jesse Jackson's, they still work. People obviously find in them something that they don't find simply in a give-and-take talk show. So I don't... They'll never be obsolete, after all. There are big occasions in our life in which we want a big celebration or a statement of big ideals, whether it's funerals or weddings sometimes or the launching of new endeavors of whatever sort. For those things, we want a larger human statement, and we feel disappointed when it's not there.
Gary Wills is the author of the new book, Lincoln at Gettysburg. In the second half of today's show, Gary Wills will be back to talk about political oratory today, and he'll tell us about his recent visit with Ross Perot. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Jerry Gross with Fresh Air. When Ross Perot makes a speech, he sounds like a salesman. That's the opinion of Gary Wills, the author of a new book about Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. Coming up in the second part of our interview with Wills, we get his evaluation of the public speaking styles of Perot, President Bush, and several other political leaders. Also, we ask Wills about his recent visit with Perot. Wills is the author of critical studies of three presidents, Kennedy, Nixon, and Reagan. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new albums by three rap groups that disprove some of the cliches about rap. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The G7 summit has endorsed the possible use of military force in order to protect relief groups in Bosnia, where UN forces have managed to keep the airport at Sarajevo open for relief supplies and food and medicine. Malcolm Brabant filed this report for the BBC.
The possibility of Western military action against the Serbs will lift spirits in Sarajevo. The Bosnian Defense Minister, Jerko Doko, says the international community has a moral obligation to protect its people. Military intervention has just become a reality for French and Canadian soldiers of the United Nations contingent. They were forced to shoot back in anger after coming under sniper fire. There's a severe danger of such exchanges increasing and, as one observer put it, of Sarajevo becoming the UN's Vietnam. The UN is also concerned about a warning by Mr. Doko that an attempt by Bosnian forces to break the siege is imminent. This would force the suspension of the airlift, but the operation, now in its fifth day, is running relatively smoothly, although some supplies have found their way onto the black market.
Malcolm Brabant reporting for the BBC. A widely used allergy drug can become deadly for some people. The Food and Drug Administration has called for a new warning label for Seldane, a prescription antihistamine. Officials say that Seldane can cause an abnormal heartbeat if someone takes too much or combines it with certain other drugs. NPR's Michael Skola reports.
Seldane is a hot-selling allergy drug because it stops your sneezing without making you tired. And for most people, it is extremely safe. But there's new evidence that in certain rare cases, the drug puts a normal heartbeat into an irregular and deadly rhythm. If you take Seldane, you should avoid two other drugs, erythromycin, a commonly prescribed antibiotic, and Nizoral, used to fight fungal infections. These drugs will cause Seldane to build up in the blood, just as if you had taken an overdose, and at a high enough level, Seldane can disrupt the heart's electrical system. People with liver disease are also prone to a buildup of Seldane and should avoid it. 2 years ago, the company that makes Seldane warned doctors about the potential problem. Now, because of the new evidence, the FDA wants an even stronger warning to doctors and patients. This is Michael Skoller in Washington.
Secretary of State James Baker says while Western leaders meeting in Munich have made progress in agreeing on world trade rules, he is disappointed that a dispute over ending a farm subsidy could not be settled. Officials of the United States and the European Community are deadlocked over cuts in government payments to EC farmers. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 44 points to close at 3,295.17 on volume of 219 million shares. This is NPR News. According to the Children's Defense Fund, the number of children living in poverty in the United States increased by more than 1 million during the 1980s. The group found that there was an increase of poor children in the nation by more than 11% during the 1980s, with child poverty rates going up in 33 states. In 1989, a family of three was considered to be living in poverty if household income was less than $9,885 a year. In Los Angeles, Mayor Tom Bradley and other city officials have proposed a property tax to raise money for extra police officers. L.A. has fewer police officers per capita than any other major U.S. city. NPR's Ina Jaffe reports.
There is no money available in the city treasury, Los Angeles Mayor Tom Bradley said today, so we come to the last resort, the people of the city. LA's budget crunch led the city to cut the police force by 400 officers, down to just 7,900 in the fiscal year that began this month. The proposed new tax would raise $100 million a year, allowing the police department to hire 1,000 additional patrol officers and 200 civilian employees. If the measure is passed by the city council, it will appear as a ballot initiative in the November election and require the approval of two-thirds of the voters. The property tax for a typical 1,500-square-foot home would go up by about $73 per year, and voters have rejected similar proposals twice during the 1980s. But one city councilwoman suggested that the recent riots may have changed voters' attitudes, saying that now times are more desperate. I'm Ina Jaffe in Los Angeles.
The Pentagon's top financial official has been named acting Secretary of the Navy. 36-year-old Sean O'Keefe has been appointed to the post for 120 days. Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney says O'Keefe is being named to an acting post because Senate confirmation is not immediately required. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. With the political conventions coming up, we wanted to get Gary Will's evaluation of the oratory styles of today's politicians. Wills is the author of Lincoln at Gettysburg, a study of the Gettysburg Address, which we discussed in the first part of our show. Wills is also the author of three critical studies of presidents, the Kennedy imprisonment, Nixon Agonistis, and Reagan's America. And he profiled Ross Perot in a recent issue of the New York Review of Books, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. During the 1984 Democratic Convention, Mario Cuomo stole the show with his keynote address. He's just agreed to give the nominating speech for Bill Clinton next week. I asked Wills if he thinks Cuomo is the best orator in the Democratic Party today.
I think he probably is. I think that it's not simply that he writes his own things, which I think by and large he does, probably not the little statements on the anniversary of this or that, but he has a sense of the past. He refers a great deal to his upbringing, his situation in society, his Italian heritage and that kind of thing. I think that helps an orator to give you a sense that his whole person is in it. Also, he does try more than most orators anyway to call people to something higher, not simply to please them, to say what they want to hear. I won't raise your taxes. I will get the government off your back. I will let you live your life undisturbed. You don't have to do anything yourself. You don't have to be citizens with duties. He doesn't say that, and Lincoln didn't say that. Lincoln called on people to really undergo tremendous sacrifices, and people resist that, of course. People resist change. What Lincoln did was go back to something that they valued. He kept saying over and over, if you don't do this, then you're giving up on the Declaration of Independence, which we profess to love. We profess to love the country that was dedicated to such a high set of goals. Well, Cuomo does that, too, by going back to family values, not simply to excoriate Murphy Brown or something of that sort, but to say we have to reach out to other people for the very reasons that brought us and our ancestors here to this country where we could have opportunity with cooperation from the people around us.
What do you think of George Bush's style as a political speaker?
It's incoherent. You know, these things that publish his Bushisms are just running out of material, space to print all of the material. Everything he says seems to be so disjointed and wandering. One really wonders if he has any attention span at all.
And what about when he's making a speech that's been written for him?
Usually, I think he tries too hard to sound tougher than he easily does. You know, Roger Ailes was constantly trying to get him mad so that he would seem to have a backbone. But when he gets mad, sometimes it just turns out to be a kind of tiny fury, a snit.
What do you think Jesse Jackson has added to political political oratory style with his kind of preacherly approach and his repetition? And
well, that, of course, he's a Baptist preacher, and they have the refrains, the, you know, Dr. King said, I have a dream, I have a dream, I have a dream, on this mountain, on that mountain, on that mountain. That's a regular part of the black preacher tradition. And it comes mainly from repeating Bible texts, that you're supposed to meditate on a text and expound it and unpack it so that you keep going back to it over and over and over. And, of course, that comes out even in the triple repetitions in the blues. That's very powerful. It's very natural to language. And as I say, Lincoln does it in the triplets that he has in his speech. We cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow, etc. Jesse Jackson is a powerful orator. He goes on sometimes when beyond his effects, but he really is good. And there are a lot of good black orators, and there are, in fact, a lot of good white preachers, too. As I say, that's the last home, almost, of rhetorical heightening that still has some sincere core to it.
You know, I was going to ask you what you think of Perot as an orator. I'm not sure I've heard Perot make a speech. I mean, I've heard him be interviewed and on sound bites.
I heard him speak to the press club. It's essentially a series of one-liners, even in the speech format. He's a salesman, and he wants to get a reaction after each thing. You know, he'll say, well, we should agree on this, right? You know, he wants to take you step by step to clinch the sale. And he tries to involve people in so that they have to nod their head or that kind of thing. That works better, of course, with a single customer than with a big crowd. But that's his style is that of a salesman trying out a product. And he'll praise it and co-add it in different ways. If this angle doesn't work, then another angle will work, etc. It's a fairly disjointed style, and that's why, although he denounces sound bites, it works best in short packets.
My guest is Gary Wills, author of the new book, Lincoln at Gettysburg. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Gary Wills is my guest. You have a recent profile of Ross Perot in the New York Review of Books. What was your angle when you went down for your visit with him? What were you looking for?
Well, I wanted to see mainly what he would say when presented with alternate versions of his past. And what he mainly does is go on the attack so that he won't even listen to the charger to say, oh, that's all made up by people. When I brought up just minor criticisms, he would say, oh, you're just a victim of the Beltway. You've been breathing that poisoned air for too long. Actually, I live in Evanston, Illinois. I don't live in Washington. But his answer to all of that is to go on the attack and to try to say that he's being plotted against. He said to me, this is quite astonishing, no one ever attacked me until I started running for office. Now, I had done some homework before I went there, and I knew very well that three books at least had attacked him, and a long series of House subcommittee investigations, and a long series of General Accounting Office reports. But he creates this make-believe world in which nothing against him could possibly be true. So it's been made up recently by Republican dirty tricks people. It was never out there for anybody to find or discover. And he's very quick. He's very clever. It's very hard to pin him down. On the other hand, because he anticipates attack and suspects everything, he won't listen. Even when I was trying to say something nice about him, I said, for instance, you grew up in the 30s in East Texas, which was not known for racial sensibilities, and yet no one, so far as I know, has accused you of being a racist. And he said, well, they will any minute, you see. And he said, but I'm not a racist. You go talk to Jesse Jackson. You go talk to Leontyne Price. You go talk to Colin Powell. They'll tell you, I'm not a racist. Why are you saying that? So he took it as if I had attacked him for racism. It's quite exactly the opposite of what I had done.
In talking about Ross Perot, the myth, one of the things that you wrote about, maybe other people knew this, I certainly didn't, was that that movie and book, The Wings of Eagles, that was based on one of his rescue missions, he hired Ken Follett to write that.
Absolutely. He just bought the person, and he hired the people to make the TV series. At any rate, he had approval of everything. He approved the actors. He approved the script. He approved the tremendous departures from reality in the script. For instance, they go in shooting guns in the TV series. They never did that in real life. He's a tremendous arranger of his own image, and he pays a lot of money for it. And if anybody challenges him, he really goes after them. Todd Mason, who did the first book about him, said that he couldn't find anybody who could verify that he had done some of the things that he did in his youth. And Perot went after the publisher and went after Mason, had all kinds of people calling up, trying to get retractions. He's really concerned about this image that he has, that he's created for himself. And he says over and over that he never exaggerates, whereas everybody exaggerates somewhat, and he does it a lot. So that almost everything you explore about him turns out to be a distortion in some ways on his part when it's not an outright lie. And I think it's that he's not really even conscious of it. It's that salesman mentality, is that I'll say what works to clinch the sale. And if I can convince you that such and such is true, then that's the reality. That's what I'll work with.
Obviously, the Ross Perot myth has, to some extent, really tapped into something in the American psyche, or at least it was tapping into it. I think his popularity has really decreased recently. But what do you think the Ross Perot image has tapped into?
Well, I look not at other third-party candidates who were, after all, most of them politicians who had long political experience, whether George Wallace as a Democratic judge and governor and Theodore Roosevelt as an ex-president. But he's more like these people for whom the Americans go on an emotional binge. For instance, Douglas MacArthur, when he was fired by Truman, he came home to an extraordinary outpouring of admiration and love, even. His polls were way up and Truman's were way down. And there was this boom that went on for half a year to make him president. He was much more moving than Perot has been. We've had other things like that. The Joe McCarthy, there was a tremendous wave of attempt to make him president at one time. People tend to forget that. Even at the end of Eisenhower's first year in office, when he was continuing to attack a Republican, he was running with 50 and above approval rating in the polls. What happens, I think, is that a disorientation, either in the Depression or at the time of the Korean War, in the case of MacArthur, a war that we didn't seem to be winning or declaring or doing any of the things that we had done in World War II, hits people. And I think there is a tremendous disorientation right now because the Cold War ended. And it's very hard to exaggerate how much of our national life was based on a politics of anti-communism. And when that's taken away, and especially when we've had a run of presidents who say fighting commies is what the government is good at, everything else it's bad at, everything else it's just on your back, it's a burden, you should get rid of it and let the market solve everything. Well, if you take away the orientation that was given to the various factions in the Republican Party and even in the Democratic Party, then they seem to wonder, well, what is government good for? Is it just a pain? Does it just get in our way? So unless somebody can go back and define a mission for the government, a duty of citizens, a high calling, as Lincoln did in the Gettysburg Address, then I think people are going to say, we don't want politicians, we don't want governments, we want outsiders, we want somebody to come along and say, I've got the solution, even if they won't let us in on it.
Gary Wills. He's the author of the new book, Lincoln at Gettysburg. He's also a professor at Northwestern University. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. John Itstead reports from Munich and the economic summit there that talks about the possibility of military action to open up land access to Sarajevo. A new literary theory about Huckleberry Finn, a scholar in Texas, is convinced that Mark Twain borrowed the voice of an African-American boy whom he had met to use as the voice for Huckleberry Finn. Also, a discussion of W. Lee Papio Daniel and the Light Crust Doughboys in Texas, a fellow who worked for a flour company there. He had a radio program, decided he wanted to run for governor, going around the political establishment, said he would run if 50,000 people wrote in. They did, he did, and he won.
Thanks, Noah. Then and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. People often complain about rap music, that it's abrasive or that it all sounds the same. But Rocker to Ken Tucker says that's less true now than ever. Here's his review of new albums by Basshead, Arrested Development, and Me Fi Me. This is Credo by Me Fi Me.
I believe that you can be what you wanna be. High as the sun, deep as the sea, you can achieve. Plus the fraternity, me, fi, me. We stand for individuality for every free man, because the reality of a weak clan is a formality of slavery. But we can join the fraternity where you can learn to be into your own. Everyone has a throne. What fool will you rule? From the red and black, stand with me. I believe in the me, fi, me. Hey.
Acoustic guitars and percussion, lyrics recited with a cool intensity that would make Allen Ginsberg or Gil Scott-Heron proud, this is the sound of a new bohemianism in rap music as another generation of performers comes along to bend pop music to its own purposes. The most striking example of this is the debut album by Arrested Development, which has the elliptical title 3 years, 5 months, and 2 days in the life of. Where rap acts like Public Enemy and Ice-T bear down on the harsh realities of urban life, Arrested Development expresses those frustrations in a different way, by yearning for a simpler time and place. The group's big hit single, Tennessee, talks about getting back to the country and appreciating family values in a way that rings a lot truer than anything Dan Quayle has called for.
Yeah. Lord, it's obvious we got a relationship. We're talking to each other every night and day. Although you're superior over me, we talk to each other in a friendship way. Then out of nowhere, you tell me to break out of the country and into more countries. Past eyes burn into rhythms. Where the ghost of childhood haunts me. Walk the road my forefathers walked, climb the trees my forefathers hung from. Ask those trees for all their wisdom. They tell me my ears are so young. Go back to whence you came. My family tree, my family name. For some strange reason it had to be. He guided me to Tennessee. Take me to a
Arrested Development is led by Todd Thomas, who uses the stage name Speech, which tips you off to his interest not only in words, but in the sound of them, the music of speech. Thomas has been influenced by the oldest bluesmen, as well as the newest hip-hoppers, and he clearly appreciates Sly and the Family Stone's idealistic eclecticism. Here's his salute to Sly Stone, a quirky inversion of Everyday People, called People Every Day.
My day was going great, and my soul was at ease, until a group of brothers started bugging out, drinking the 40 ounce, going the nigga route, disrespecting my black queen, holding their crotches and being obscene. At first I ignored them, cause see I know the type. They got drunk and got guns and they wanna fight. And they see a young couple having a time that's good, and the eagles wanna touch the brother's manhood. So they came to test speech cause of my hairdo and the loud bright colors that I wear. I was the target cause misfit, and the outfit that I'm wearing, brothers dissing it. Well, I stay calm and pray the niggas leave me be. But they squeezing parts of my date's anatomy. Why, Lord, do brothers have to drill me? Cause if I start to hit this man, he'll have to kill me. See,
I am everyday people.
Yeah, yeah.
The new hip-hop bohemianism likes to make manifestos of artistic freedom, as is true of Me Fi Me, a Detroit rapper that I played at the beginning of this review. But bohemianism has always had its vague, muzzy-headed side, too, flaunting the freedom to be incoherent, declining to offer solutions to the world's problems. So it is with Basshead, a band led by Michael Ivey. Basshead's debut, Play With Toys, sounds like the work of some especially clever college students, fueled in equal measure by Afrocentrism and pot.
Yo, so what's been up with your girl, man? My heart feels like it's been over and over again on a rollercoaster ride. And the pain that I feel on the inside, wisely covered up with pride. Oh, man. They say every cloud is aligning, but like the sky, I am still blue.
Yeah, don't be blue.
The sweat in my face, not crying, even though my tongue got you.
Keep going.
Keep thinking over and over, and don't you know that it's a shame?
It's a bit of a
that
shame.
We've been together for so long, now I'm thrown back into the game. Drinks, getting names, silly dates, silly dames. All this silly stuff I go through, you know I wish they're still the same. Say every cloud is aligning, but I wonder if it's true.
But you
know if it gets me crying, even though no, I don't got you.
Consider the positives, man.
Well, now I think about it, I can do what I want to.
Right.
I'm going to whatever I choose.
I'll do whatever I want to, whatever I choose, mumbles Michael Ivey on that song, Brand New Day. On another tune, Not Over You, he observes, everybody says I'm sitting here because I'm missing you, but maybe I'm sitting here because sitting is what I do. Like the other hip-hop bohemians, there's a quiet elation here. It's the serene thrill of making loose, idiosyncratic music. Marginal stuff that's already moving into the mainstream as a positive, invigorating force.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Joan Tuohy, and Roberta Shorrock, with Sue Weinstein and Deborah Beagle. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Go out by myself and watch the people as they go by. Everybody's looking for the place way up in the sky. All look full of like the lives wouldn't be the same. As if to be alone were something to be ashamed. Why do folks claim no one alone is one lonely? Just cause I'm alone, it don't mean that I'm not happy. So judge me true about what I say, not what I do. Why do folks continue to say that I'm not over you? Not over you. No, everybody tells me that I should be with someone.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we call journalist Slavenka Draculic at her home in the Croatian capital, Zagreb. There's no fighting there, the shops are well stocked, but life has been changed by the influx of refugees from nearby Sarajevo. I'm Terry Gross, I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.